From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in February of 2011, when 19-year-old Jordan Porco died by suicide during his freshman year of college. Jordan's sister Taylor was 5 years younger, 14 years old, and she had looked up to Jordan. She said he was her rock, her place of stability during tough times, and suddenly he was gone. Until recently, almost no one had studied the impact of suicide on sibling survivors, and Taylor's story is one powerful example of the challenges that arise. She was depressed, and she lost some of her friendships. She told NPR that most of her peers left her alone. They were as scared to reach out to her or to talk to her at all. She felt isolated. It impacted her school and home life. Finally, a few years go by, it comes time for her to think about going to college, and her parents told her she can't go. They were still devastated from the loss of her brother, and they initially refused to support her going away to school. Now consider the fact that more than 40,000 people die by suicide in this country. Well, that's in the past last year alone. And that leaves tens of thousands of sibling survivors like Taylor. And the numbers have been climbing in the past two decades. The National Center for Health Statistics reports that in 1999, 29,000 Americans died by suicide. 15 years later, nearly 43,000 people died by suicide. This is a conversation on the impacts and the sometimes hidden impacts of suicide. My guests in studio include Patrick Scahill. Pat's the founder and chairman of the Superfly Corporation. What is Superfly? Tell us just a little bit about Superfly.
The Superfly is my brother's nickname. That was just kind of one of those things that we always know him as. We always called him the Superfly. Always loved tattoos, had a lot of fun. He was all about a great time. So that's where we started the Superfly of, in memory of him.
Welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Tim Garbach is on the board at Meg's Gift. What is Meg's Gift, Tim?
Meg's Gift is an organization that we created, the family and loved ones of Megan, to kind of nurture her legacy and to talk about intervention, so things that we can do to help and intervene and take some of the stigma away from suicide.
Thank you for being here as well. Adrian Daniels is manager of bereavement services for Lifetime Care. And Adrian, we're going to be talking about support groups and related issues this hour. Thanks for taking the time to be here as well.
You're welcome.
A brief hello from my colleague Veronica Volk, who's in studio. This is an important morning at WXXI because after the Thanksgiving interlude, there is a podcast that we are very proud of that talks about inclusion that has some really compelling stories, and episode 3 is finally here of Exited. Hello.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me on. And I am going to keep this brief because I don't want to detract from this conversation. But this podcast has been about transitions, right? So we're talking about what happens when students with disabilities are exited from the school system. And one of the options for students who maybe aren't headed towards higher ed or a more traditional job is this program that I was completely unaware of, work programs called Sheltered Workshops. They're a little bit controversial because they are segregated from the rest of the segregated from the rest of the community, and the people in them are also often paid below minimum wage. So we kind of get into this a little bit, and if you haven't heard the podcast yet, I would really suggest you start with this one, because it is just, it's really interesting the way that my colleague Karen kind of focuses in on this one woman who works at a sheltered workshop who's at kind of the center of all this tension. And you really go on this journey with her as she learns about sheltered workshops, go through this journey through the past. You know, I said something about how we have special guests RBG and FDR this week, referring to Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And it's really just like a journey through Karen's experience learning about sheltered workshops. And I really suggest you tune in. So you can find us at exitedpodcast.org or on iTunes or any of the other places where you'd get your podcasts.
I want to employ listeners on something here. If you are the kind of person who maybe you've listened to a few podcasts, maybe you hear Radiolab on when it's broadcast on NPR, maybe you're really into it and you hear other things. I don't know if you've ever thought about what goes into the creation of it. The first thing that goes in is no sleep, and that's Karen Chakurji and Veronica Volk for weeks now. But research, editing, careful, thoughtful storytelling, this stuff is so good. You do not have to have anyone in your family with a disability. Listen to this episode, and you're probably going to go back, and then you're going to say, I got to listen to 1, 2, we're going to subscribe, we're going to listen to, because there's going to be 5, I think, right?
That's right. And all of the episodes are unique and dear to my heart in different ways. This episode is unique in that we bring in a lot of archival sound And we let a lot of interviews between Karen and some of the people who are overseeing these workshops kind of play out. And you really hear like a lot of the tension, a lot of the emotion, a lot of the contradiction. And I'm really proud of them, and I'm really proud of my colleague, Karen Chakurji. So I implore people to listen.
And RBG and FDR.
That's right.
Congratulations again on the work that's being done on Exit. It's important stuff. Subscribe now. Episode 3 out now. Thank you, Veronica Volk.
Thank you, Evan.
We're talking this hour about the impact of suicide on siblings. And a recent United Kingdom survey of more than 3,400 bereaved young adults ages 18 to 40, again, who lost a friend or relative by suicide, found 20% of them received no formal or even informal mental health support. So that's a fifth with nothing at all. And my guess is, Adrian Daniels, that does not surprise you. No?
Not at all. A lot of people are oftentimes afraid to seek out help, too, which complicates it. And it's a time when people need the support the most.
Yeah, I mean, I think when we have talked about suicide for years on this program, we talk about prevention. We talk about fears in addressing it for those who are sort of speaking about their own ideations and thoughts. But we haven't talked about this, and we haven't talked about the impact on siblings and people left behind. And so I want to start with Pat Scahill again, who is the founder and chairman of the Superfly Corporation. And I'll let you, in terms you'd like, tell your own story first, and we'll talk about the impact. But tell us a little bit about what happened, Pat.
My brother was a sergeant in the Marine Corps and in California, and got a call the day after Easter in 2010 that Martin had taken his own life. We knew things had kind of gotten a little haywire for the months leading up to that, drinking more, sounding a little bit more angry about life. Tried to make a few phone calls, but they went unanswered. I think for my family, when we're talking about bereavement, counseling, stuff like that, I come from a family where my grandmother committed suicide in the 70s. My father committed suicide in 2004. My brother committed suicide in 2010. I had a cousin commit suicide just a few years ago. So this is something that is a part of, I don't want to say it's a part of the family, but it's something that we are used to in a sad sort of way. So I think it's a little bit more difficult sometimes. It just trying to understand, especially when you have so many people around you, not think that they're loved.
I don't want to, I don't know how to even ask this, but I just ache for your family, thinking about that family history. You lost your dad to suicide when?
In 2004.
And then your brother in 2010?
Yes, sir.
I mean, does it feel in 2010 like, not again, I can't believe this? I mean, I am so sorry.
When it comes as a shock, when you wake up and you are told that you can no longer hold that person, love that person, laugh with that person, because they decided something, that's what hurts the most, that there is no closure. And I think that's one of the things about suicide that's so difficult for people like us right now, the siblings, is that there is no closure. There's so many things left questioned. There's so many things left unanswered that you can't. People get mad. People get angry. People want to blame. People just hate, shut off. They do whatever they want to do. But I think one of the things that we've tried to do here is move past and try to create memories, because that's all we have of them. That's it.
This is according to Dr. David Brent, a psychiatrist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. A first-degree relative, that is, including siblings, of a person who has committed suicide is 4 to 6 times more likely to attempt suicide. And does your family talk about that at this point? I mean, do you worry about getting another call in the future of this nature, or do you find a way not to have that consume your thoughts?
When it comes to my immediate, so I'll speak just on my immediate family. My family is very large. My brother and I talk about it. My mother and I talk about it. I speak with my children who are 10 and 12 years old. They know about it. They don't know the finite details, but they know it happens. And they know that the biggest thing is that they are loved, and that if they have anything that has gone wrong, please come talk to us, because we don't ever want to get this phone call again. The big thing is just keep talking about it. We cannot create this thing to become a taboo. if we keep talking about it, if we keep recognizing that there is a problem, we can start to make progress on this. The stat of 29,099 to 44,000 in 2014, that's staggering.
It's a big jump in suicide in this country, and right. we're still over that 40,000 mark from the latest numbers that I have seen, which represents something in the range of a 30% to 40% increase in the last two decades. So, so Pat, let's talk about what you're trying to do positively. Then, as you said, you know, that's you've got memories, you've got things you can hold on to that you can still celebrate. Tell me just a little bit more about him first. About Superfly.
He was a goofy kid. I think we've finally gotten to the point where we're laughing more than we're actually crying now, because he had so many of those spontaneous stories that just don't make any sense. So what we're trying to do is our foundation solely benefits the Veterans Outreach Center. And specifically the three houses, the Richards and Otto House and the Priscilla House that they have for their halfway homes. So we've started over the last 3 years doing a golf tournament, and now we're morphing into a little bit more outreach, just smaller events throughout the year. But we specifically go to the Veterans Outreach Center because my brother was active duty Marine, and, you know, our family is now a Gold Star family.
What does it mean to them? I mean, have you had conversations with the folks there? Do they know the story at Veterans Outreach Center?
Oh, yeah. One of the people that I deal with most is Lindsay Chambers, and she's an incredible woman. And we've kind of gone through some of this process, and they are so supportive of what we're trying to do. They're there for us all the time. Whatever we need, whatever they can do, we've had nothing but support from them.
And so now Superfly is going to do, you know, in 10 years, in 25 years, when people hear about Superfly Corp, what are we going to think of, you think?
The most fun golf tournament you've ever been in, and people just trying to create as many positive stories. During our tournaments, the biggest prize actually goes to whoever has the best story of the day. Not the winner, not the loser, whoever has the best story, because that's what we want to make. Memories so people can think about it, so hopefully it'll stop them from doing something dark in a dark time.
And on the treatment side, on the help side, on the support side, which we're going to be talking with Adrian more about here coming up, what do you think? Let me start with this here. The first time you remember understanding suicide in your family was when? Because you've had four, but you know, when's the first one that really impacted you?
I had to be 10 years old. It was 1990. My father attempted suicide for the first time. And I was very astutely aware because I was...
You knew about it.
Yes, I was told. And going through that, realizing what it was, I mean, I went through my own depression in high school. I've gotten real close sometimes. I've had a couple times a long time ago where I get real, real close. So I understand how easy it is to go that dark. I get it. And you get to the point when your brain just cannot take any more pain. And sometimes I've come out of it because I've thought about people, I've thought about stories, I've thought about things that have just brought me out of where I was. So that's what we try to do with the Superfly.
And when it comes to the kind of support that could be there, you know, you go back to 1990 and you knew that your dad had tried. He completes suicide 14 years later. And did you feel... Do you remember feeling supported? Did you need any additional support? What was that? What was that like?
I never went to seek professional help. I think the support that we had was through our family. And that really came because my aunts and uncles, my father's brothers and sisters, had all dealt with it with their mother. So I think there was an outpouring of support from people who knew him, people who loved him, people who cared about him. I never really, though, got any sort of outgoing support. Mm-hmm. But I was also 24 years old at the time. So I didn't really, it wasn't like I was 16 years old, found myself in school and realized I need help. But I never got that back in the...
I think what you're saying is you're 24, you would have had to initiate that on your own, probably?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
And same kind of thing when you lost your brother?
Yes, same kind of thing when I lost my brother.
And
yes.
You're 30, and right. You lose your brother, and so you, support from the family that unfortunately has been there.
Right.
But you'd have to initiate outside of that. Adrian, is there any way to change that setup? Again, I don't want to. No one wants to talk about mandating sort of, or I don't know, treatment. But Do you have any thoughts on that kind of support? Because he's right. I mean, he's 24. He's 30 years old. He's lost a dad and then a brother to suicide. Mm-hmm. But if he doesn't seek out that kind of help outside of his family, it may not happen.
Well, I think just like trying to reduce the stigma associated with suicide, I think just talking about it and talking about receiving help and reducing that stigma will help. I think the more we raise awareness, the better it will be. The American Foundation for Suicide Prevention is working really hard to kind of reduce that and raise awareness. So I think the more we get out there, the better. It's just very challenging to reach people after a loss. In my context with hospice, it's very easy because we reach out to every family member that goes through the hospice program. But, you know, suicide loss is just so sudden that it's hard. Maybe our medical professionals and educating them and talking to law enforcement professionals and just raising awareness about what supports are available would be helpful.
Yeah, Adrian, I have friends who, they said something years ago that I've never forgotten. They said, you do not just brush your teeth when you have a cavity. And so why do we treat therapy or counseling as if only when you're in crisis? Now, this is a case where, certainly, when there is a crisis, when there has been a suicide, I would think anybody could probably benefit from that kind of a thing. But then you said the word stigma. Mm-hmm. We still have this idea that therapy equals problem, therapy equals something wrong. If you tell anybody listening, if you say to a friend tonight, hey, I've got to go to therapy tomorrow, they're probably going to say, what's wrong? As opposed to, oh, that's healthy, that's good. What are you going to talk about? It's just, do you disagree? I mean, I still feel like that stigma might prevent people from, even in crisis, feeling like it's okay.
It definitely does exist. And even though I'm a licensed professional, I like to try to tell people that I'm not a therapist. I'm a bereavement counselor. And what I try to do is help you create that space so that I can help talk to you and help you work through and learn how you're going to, you know, grow through this experience and also give you the opportunity to talk about your loved one. You know, we were talking about that earlier, how important it is for us to be able to talk about them, because that is one of the things that is lost after a death.
Hmm. Well, so, yeah. And Pat, how are you feeling these days? When you talked about yourself and you've struggled in the past, you said you've been close, you've mm-hmm. thought about suicide, mm-hmm. You've lost family members, you know that the numbers show that family rates are higher when there has already been suicide. How are you thinking about your own sort of mental wellness, ongoing mental, just maintaining mental wellness?
That's a really good question. There's a constant focus on how you're doing. You don't usually let slip. Sometimes you have a bad day and you have to refocus and realize that I need to just kind of calm down, focus back, and go from here. The biggest thing that I focus on is less myself and more my kids. There's a constant monitoring of my 11 and 12-year-old. Continuously talking about it, continuously talking about feelings. How are you feeling? How are you doing? How are things going? I just have to keep monitoring myself. That's really where I am right now. But with the Superfly, we have a focus. And I think that's the biggest thing that I can do.
I think there's something really beautiful and admirable about a dad talking to kids about feelings. You know, that's another stigma that men can't talk about feelings. Men talk about feelings in your family?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, whether we want them to or not. Yes, in my family we do. I think some of us are a little bit more closed off with each other, but with the kids, we have to be. With the history of the family, we have to be. So,
and forgive my ignorance on this, but just given a family history of depression, when do you start thinking about that in kids? When does that manifest? I don't know the answer to this.
I've seen my daughter already start having some anxiety issues. I see her starting to exhibit some of those behaviors that I need to keep monitoring. Her mother and I have already talked about this, so this is not anything new. We are watching it.
Okay. Adrian, what about kids and depression, history of depression? What do we need to think about with them?
I think early intervention is really important, and I think you're right on by saying that parents really know best and can monitor those situations. So.
Okay, well, I want to turn to Tim Garbach, who's here. He's on the board at Meg's Gift, and can you tell us a little bit about who Meg was?
Sure. Meg was one of my four sisters. We grew up in a very loving family, and I think a lot of people who heard about Meg afterwards kind of looked at it and said, no, not that family. And I think, you know, talking to my siblings and to my parents and to people after, I think we kind of realized that suicide isn't just the thing that we saw on TV growing up and that we see on TV now and that we hear, you know, in these war stories and things. It touches everybody, every socioeconomic background, everywhere. And you can't look at somebody and say, nope, that's, you know, something like that could never happen to that family, because it can.
First suicide in your family?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
And it happened when? When did you lose her?
Megan was 28 years old. It was on in February of 2014. And she had been struggling for a couple years leading up to that point. Megan was almost, you could almost describe her as an empath. Everything that Megan did always seemed like it was for other people. Great smile. Just, if she could make you comfortable, if she could make anyone else in the room more comfortable, you know, she would do that over herself. So, you know, looking back on things, you know, we come up with some great stories that, you know, a lot of Megan's friends have come up with from, you know, her packing peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and bringing them to homeless people when she was in college out on the streets, and everybody said, Megan, it's 30 degrees outside. What are you doing? You know, and that's just the type of person that she was.
Now, you said a couple of years leading up to her loss,
mm-hmm.
she had struggled at times, just depression, or what do you mean by struggle?
Yeah, it seemed like Megan was just in a very, very dark place, and it's something that we all knew, we all talked about, we're all very open with it. Megan had sought help. She had been seeing somebody. And it was one of those things where you would look at Meg and it almost seems like she was, instead of looking at you or talking to you, she was almost looking right through you. And so in those 3 years, as we talk about it more and more, you know, there is a history of depression and anxiety in the family. And with help, you know, we thought that, you know, Megan's gonna come out of this. She's gonna make it out of this. And no one had really even thought about that the ending could happen like this.
Do you get to a point where, or maybe you weren't there to begin with? Often we hear about family members feeling a sense of blame, or do you get to a point where you can let some of that go?
I think to some extent we're always going to shoulder some sort of blame for it. You know, I think deep down you kind of understand that it's not any one person's fault or you know, I shouldn't have done this in this situation. I mean, hindsight, you're always going to look at it and think you know the right answer. But I think it's just one of those support things where, you know, of course it's very, very important for, you know, the help with professionals such as yourself, and then also being open to the family so that the person who is suffering, with the stigma going away, which is what we all hope to do, with the stigma going away, the person who is affected is the person that initiates the help, you know, and it's through family, you know, first, obviously, and then through, you know, professionals.
Listeners, we're going to get to your phone calls coming up here. Celia in Rochester, stay right there. We're coming to you in just a moment, and I appreciate you calling in. If you want to call in with questions or comments or maybe share your story or reach out in some way, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Patrick Scahill from the Superfly Corporation mentioned, you know, his thoughts about long-term, about what you can do now. I mean, there's no bringing back someone who is gone, but mm-hmm. you can honor their memory. You can try to create something positive there. They have done that. Tell me about what your goals are.
Sure. Meg's Gift is our organization, and it started out with a conversation with myself and my mother about same thing that you were saying, Pat, of, you know, let's do a golf tournament. And it started out as, you know, as that thought and something that we can do to kind of channel our energies into something that was really positive. So we had our first one, and it was a great success. And then after that, we said, you know what, it's not just about the golf tournament and bringing people together. It's about just what Pat was saying, you know, telling the best stories and, you know, kind of honoring that that legacy. So this, we had our third golf tournament, nevertheless, this year. And we always end up closing down at least two golf courses. And the amount of people and the support and the love that you feel there is absolutely incredible. So our big thing, our sole focus through what we do is to raise monies so that we can raise awareness through different organizations. Right in line with you, Pat, with Veterans Outreach, we had done in the past, TIG, as you were talking about, and the National Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And what we hope to do is really, I think the most important part of this whole thing is the intervention part. Because like you were saying, you know, somebody says, I'm going to the therapist, you automatically assume what's wrong, you know? And I think it's kind of like that through all therapy. You know, my background's in physical therapy. If I say I'm going to the physical therapist, they say, okay, what kind of surgery did you have? Sometimes I just need to have physical therapy because I want to prevent that from happening. So I think that same sort of stigma for some of the other things we need to do here, definitely.
I want to ask Tim and Pat, before I grab some phone calls now, just to let you know if people want to attend in the future, support these kinds of causes. Are you online anywhere? Find more about Meg's Gift where?
Megsgift.org. We're also Facebook, Twitter, all of the social media platforms. Anybody who knows my family, we talk about it everywhere we go, and we wear our green bracelets around, and our logo can be found on bumper stickers, and we do walks, and and not just the golf tournament, but I think this year alone, we've done 14 different events to raise awareness and to help raise monies. So it's fantastic. It's a way that we've really taken to channel a lot of these the grief.
So Meg's Gift online in various platforms and megsgift.org. Same question for you, Pat, from Superfly.
We are online. We are not quite as prolific as Meg's Gift. we do have a Facebook page set up. It is brand new. We're really trying to outgrow and keep going. We do have a website, but it's a long, complicated mess that I think we're going to clean up.
So find you guys, on Superfly.
Absolutely.
On Facebook.
The Superfly.
The Superfly. This is Celia in Rochester on the line. Go ahead, Celia.
Yes, hi. I'm calling. I'm in the car. Calling just because this topic came up, and I never hear about it on a radio show, so I'm a little bit nervous. My brother was not a veteran, so I only caught a little bit of the show. I think there's a woman there named Adrian that might be a counselor. My brother killed himself after I walked out of, or tried to kill himself as I walked out of the room in front of our mother, and he didn't die. He lived for 7 hours. And it's really hard because our whole family has broken apart from it, and friends don't know how to reach out. Even the people that you thought would, I think they don't know what to say, and they're afraid to talk to you, and you really need people to talk to you. And I wanted to go get help because I do have PTSD, and I wanted to go to the Center for Compassionate Healing, but you're almost afraid to go in the suicide group because you're afraid you're going to be so sad, and everybody's so scared that all you're going to do is cry, and you don't know if it's going to help you. So I guess I'm wondering if there's another option other than even just counseling that anybody can tell me about.
Celia, first of all, I hope you're safe driving on the road, and I want to thank you.
I pulled over.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for
that. I don't mean to be emotional. It's just a difficult topic, and when you hear it, it really brings it to the surface.
You don't have to apologize for anything, and it's important, first of all, that you at least feel like there are so many people who have been right there with you. So you're not alone at all in this, and I'm glad that you called. Let me turn over to Adrian Daniels, who's Manager of Bereavement Services for Lifetime Care.
Celia, thank you so much for your courage to call. And I'm so sad for your loss. I will tell you.
I'm glad you said courage because it does take courage, and you don't realize don't realize that it does.
Yeah, I recognize that anytime anyone calls our center, it takes a lot to make that first call. And you hear my voice now, so maybe we can connect after the show. Okay. I would be happy to meet with you sometime and kind of like lead you down the path and have you come and meet me, and then you can see where we are. You know, there are a lot of tears in the support group because, I mean, we have to work through those tears together, but we also have a lot of fun, surprisingly. There's You know, we have a little bit of humor, and everybody is very loving and supporting and warm, but sometimes it takes a lot to work up to that, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it sounds like you have had a lot of loss and a lot of trauma, as you mentioned, so it would be helpful to talk to someone.
Yes. And, you know, the one thing I do need, too, that I haven't really found a lot in, is, and I didn't know if at the center there that you do deal with PTSD. I mean, I have it from having, when he shot himself, and I had to go back in the room and be with him until the police arrived, and he was still alive, and I couldn't help him, and it's a horrible thing to view. He shot himself in the head, so it's kind of a double whammy, and my sister died 3 weeks prior to that, and she couldn't help herself. So my sister dies, and then my brother kills himself, and he does it in front of our mother with me after I walk out of the room. It was really bad. So people just think that, you know, time will heal all wounds, and it's a lot more complicated than that.
Exactly. Suicide is a very complicated... So I am not an expert in PTSD. However, I have a lot of great resources, so I would be happy to connect with them to you.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Would it be okay if I got your phone number after the show?
Yeah.
Celia, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put you back on hold, and Audrey's going to jump on the line with you, and we'll get your information. But
okay.
But I just want to tell you, before I do that, again, I just want to tell you that how much I do admire you, and I know you're going through a lot. And let me just ask, if I could, Pat and Tim, just to kind of give you some thoughts, because certainly it's more complicated than just time heals all wounds, that you don't get to snap your finger, and it's perfect. But you did hear from Pat that as time goes on, you know, Pat, you said you can think more toward laughter than tears these days. So some thoughts for Celia?
Celia, I would just say I'm very sorry for your family, and sometimes it takes a while for the full breadth of what's happened to actually make sense. And in some ways, it may be harder for you going forward for a little bit. You will eventually, though, start thinking broader, and you'll start feeling a little bit better. Like you talked about, that courage to wake up in the morning and go to work.
Yes, yes.
So
very difficult to do.
I'm very sorry for you and your family.
Thank you so
much. Tim, some thoughts for her?
Hi, Celia. I'm sorry for your loss, and I admire your courage as well. You had said that it's torn your family apart a little bit.
Yeah, completely.
So I'm going to guess that's kind of the, for lack of a better term, some of the collateral damage that happens from a suicide.
So I mean, it's a double whammy, you know?
Right. So I guess if I could offer any words, I would say that you have already done the most important thing, and that was just to reach out. As you start to do things on your own, you will encourage, you will touch one or two people in the family and encourage them to, you know, to get to seek help as well. And then the whole dynamic of the family becomes one of healing. But it starts with you, and you recognize that, and I admire you. So hopefully they'll be able to see that, and you'll see it in a completely different dynamic with the family of healing together. But you initiated it, and I say I feel
what
for you.
What do you do about, and it's funny because I'm the only one, it seems, that isn't blaming others. And everybody's blaming everybody, and... you know, it's nobody's fault, and it seems like some blame is being put on me, even though I was the one that was there to help them, so it's scary, because I know they don't know how to deal with it either, but how do you deal with people blaming you when there's nothing to do with you?
Let me turn to Adrian just for some thoughts on that. Go ahead, Adrian.
Yeah, you know, I think it's human nature to want to place blame on something in a situation like that, and it's kind of hard to find some accountability for our loved ones too that go through it. So, you know, it's perfectly natural for that to happen. And just talking about it and working through that can be helpful for families.
Celia, I'm going to put you on hold, and Audrey's going to get your information. Okay. Thanks for taking the time to call the program, and good luck to you.
Thank you all.
All right. And let me grab Joel in Rochester, who's also waiting to join the conversation. Go ahead, Joel.
I want to first say to Pat and Tim and the previous caller that I'm sorry for your loss. I'm also sorry for all of you that you're part of a group that you never wanted to be or join, which is the suicide survivors. I want to make 2 points, and I don't want to go have more time go by before these are said. The first one relates to suicide survivors, and this goes for anybody who is not a suicide survivor, but yet who might want to help. And I think, you know, in addition to not saying, you know, time heals all wounds, it's important to try to avoid telling people, you know, I know how you feel, or hang in there, because suicide is unlike any other death, whether it's death by accident, a car accident, or illness, or anything like that. I've experienced a lot of death in my life, and suicide is not like anything else. And there really is oftentimes no closure for suicide survivors. At least that's been my impression and work that I've done. And then my second comment deals with somebody who is suicidal. Words are extremely important. You cannot talk around this issue. It's not good enough to say to someone or ask someone, are you planning to harm yourself or are you planning to hurt yourself? And I've heard that from teachers, therapists, parents, and friends. You need to be explicit in your questions. Are you planning to kill yourself? Do you have a plan to commit suicide? And you need to be direct about those. And if the answer is yes, you need to take it seriously and get help immediately. No expression of suicidality is to be underestimated. And lastly, I want to say that if there are guns in the home, whether it's because you're a hunter or otherwise, that you remove them immediately. You know, just give your guns to a friend, because oftentimes they're used as the easiest way to take your life. So those are my two comments, and I'll take your questions or comments off the air.
Joel, thank you. I appreciate the phone call again. I'm sorry. He's right. I mean, no one wants to be part of that community. But once you become part of the community, the question becomes, what can you do to make it as strong and positive as possible? So let me just work backwards before I turn to the panel for some reaction. Joel did mention guns, and certainly attempted suicides are more likely to not be completed suicides if they do not involve a gun. We do know that is true. Adrian, do you agree that if you know someone has suicidal ideation, it's worth finding out if there are firearms there?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's definitely a big part of a suicide assessment.
Okay. And some other thoughts that Joel had just about the language and the way you communicate with someone who's making those kinds of comments.
Yeah, we like to call those platitudes, bereavement bloopers. It's such a different type of loss. It's like an onion with so many different layers that need to be peeled back. And it's a time when I'm sure both of you have felt this way, where people didn't really talk to you, wouldn't come up to you. A lot of people say it's like feeling like you have cancer after you have a loss. And that's a time when people really want to be talking about it and sharing their story and talking about their loved ones. So I encourage people to reach out to somebody who is grieving and not just say in a card, you know, whatever you need, I'll be there for you, but actually have specific things that you can do to help somebody.
Yeah, I go back to that story that that NPR reported on, you know, a 14-year-old girl who loses her 19-year-old brother, and then her friends around her, she told NPR that no one wanted to talk to her. They felt like, maybe they felt like, I don't know what to say. Maybe they felt like, you know, they weren't sure they didn't want to make it worse. But either way, she felt isolated. She cannot be alone there. I mean, that's what these studies that are coming from various places in recent years about siblings who've lost are indicating that that's what happens here, or at least it can, right, Adrian?
Yeah, and I mean, it really is because people don't know what to say or do, and they don't want to make it worse, and they're afraid of, you know, creating emotion in the person, but in actuality, it's hurtful. You know, we feel like we're abandoned after a loss.
And so again, everybody's different. Everybody responds differently. I mean, some people might want to hear anything. I don't know. But Tim, is there anything that you can add just in terms of what people might say to survivors, to sibling survivors who, when they're trying to do their best for you, but they don't know what to say?
Yeah, it's difficult. They sorry for your loss is one of the biggest ones, but to the point of the caller that called in, I don't think he was necessarily saying what to say afterwards. Mm-hmm. I think he was trying to get to, what do you say to someone who you think is imminent? So just to if I can respond to that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I wish that people really, really hear that and make that part of your communication process. If someone is thinking about harming themselves, they are not mm-hmm. sugarcoating it, mm-hmm. right? Not at all. And so we can't do that when we talk to them. But yeah, so fast forward after, what do they say? I can see how a 14-year-old or a 15-year-old would say, you know, maybe I'm too afraid to talk to that person. I don't know what to say. But I think that legitimizes even more, and it gives even more credence to why we're trying to do what we do of, you know, taking the stigma away, because it is such a stigma. It almost leads into, well, it has in this situation, so it leads to inaction. And sometimes that's very hurtful. So, you know, be open, be honest, say what you feel, and you are not going to you're not going to hurt the feelings of someone who lost somebody because you don't know what to say. I think the action of even coming up in the first place is very important.
Yeah, you know, Pat, I remember a friend who lost a close relative, and I won't go any further than that, but I was in that feeling of saying, well, if I bring it up again or if I check in, am I going to be planting a seed? Am I going to make them sad? And she eventually said to me, I think about this all the time. So you saying that you care is only a good thing. You're not going to make me think about this loss because I haven't been thinking about it for days. And all of a sudden, oh, Evan reminded me. She said, you're doing something that... So it pushed me to say, get out of my own head and show that I care. What do you think?
You're absolutely right. I mean, stepping back and taking a look at what you have sitting in front of you. Like, I could sit at home and cry and it'd be sad my entire life, but it doesn't actually do anything. It doesn't help anyone. So I go through my own grief process by helping others.
Mm. And in that sense of, well, don't put that thought in your head. People who lose, and maybe over time, over many years, maybe over time you get to a point where it's not on your mind every 5 minutes or every 10 minutes or every hour. And that's natural. That doesn't mean you didn't love your brother or your mm-hmm. dad or someone or your sister or someone you lost. But that I think that probably still doesn't change the fact that if someone offers support or a loving thought,
right,
it's going to bring you down, I wouldn't think.
No, it never brings me down. But I never genuinely, like, I wouldn't look across the table and say, man, I completely understand what you're going through. I don't understand what you're going through. Your story is unique. Your story is different. I just say, I'm really sorry. Do you want to talk about it? Because that's all I can do. Listen.
Yeah. Adrian, any thoughts just on that communication level? I think these guys have said it really, really well. Nobody really, and they've each lost a sibling mm-hmm. to suicide, and they would say to each other, I don't technically know what you're going through. I mean, I understand the idea of losing a sibling, but every situation is different. And I think that's important. What do you think?
Oh, it is important. And actually, it's interesting because I like to think that I am not an expert in grief. Each person I work with is their own expert. And my goal is to try to help them uncover that and unravel it. But to be supportive for somebody after a loss is really, really important. There's an expression we use when the casseroles end. When all the support kind of disappears, that's when somebody will really need to reach out the most. The dust settles. You were talking a little bit about that fog. So when that fog starts to lift and the pain starts to set in, to be present with them and just share stories about the loved one, you know.
So as we get into our last few minutes of the program, I want to hit a couple of things. Adrian Daniels is manager of bereavement services for Lifetime Care. We've talked about individual counseling. We've talked about family support. What about support groups? What would you want our community to know about groups that might be available to help?
Support groups are one of the best ways to go through loss, even more so than individual counseling sometimes, because you can be with other people who are going through it. Friendships develop. You can talk about that grit that you can't talk about with other people, share similar experiences, and help support each other through it. So we have a suicide loss support group at Lifetime Care that was created within the past 10 years. They meet on the first and third Tuesdays of every month at our Center for Compassion and Healing. It's located at 3111 Winton Road South in Henrietta. People are welcome to call our center at 475-8800.
Do it again.
475-8800. and there's no fee. If you ever need any linkage to a therapist or some more support, come to one of our support groups. We're here for you.
I had talked to a friend who lost a family member to suicide, and she was participating in a group that did all kinds of she described some of the activities, and I thought they were really interesting. Some of it were kind of writing workshops, kind of expressing in different ways, and occasionally just writing for yourself, but sometimes writing to share with the group, or and that can be really tough, but she said there was so much good that came out of that.
There's a lot of power in writing. And as I was saying, each of us is an expert in our own grief. We're going to tap into our grief in different ways. So some people will do it through writing. We'll do it through a support group. We'll do it through music, all different ways. So it's just a matter of finding the right fit.
Okay. And so if you try a group and maybe it isn't the right fit at first, it doesn't mean there isn't other things out there that might work. Is that
That's
right?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay. So if you are sort of in this category, if you're someone like Celia, if you're thinking about this, there are more resources in this community than sometimes we realize around us. And we don't want you to leave this hour without realizing that some of those resources are there. And with suicide rising to the second leading cause of death among adolescents, the American Academy of Pediatrics has published updated guidelines advising pediatricians how to identify and help teenagers at risk. That's as recently as last year these new guidelines came out. And the Academy recommends pediatricians routinely ask adolescent patients if they have thoughts of harming themselves and screen for other factors associated with increased suicide risk. And they said pediatricians should refer patients for appropriate mental health evaluation and treatment when needed. Adrian, how do you feel about that recommendation from the American Academy of Pediatrics as a general guideline for health for teenagers? Not, you know, if someone comes in and presents with X, then you ask, but generally asking.
I think it's a great idea. I don't do a lot of work with children. We do have a bereavement support group for children and teens, which is great. There are several families who have gone through by a suicide loss, but yeah, we should be having these conversations and talking more. And I think a lot more schools are trying to put social workers in to really kind of assess the situation on a broader level.
And one of our listeners wants to know your thoughts about numbness as being a warning sign.
Numbness is actually a very common side effect of grief right after a loss.
After loss?
Yes, because the way I kind of look at it is like if we felt all of our grief at one time, I don't know how we would react to it. So we have like a natural defense mechanism that eventually wears off, which is why I'm looking at the guys because they're nodding, but we oftentimes go through like the pain kind of increases months down the line. So it's not uncommon for people to start really feeling their grief 6 to 8 months out. So numbness could be a factor, but it's also a common side effect of a normal grief reaction.
Okay, Pat, you want to land in a little bit on that?
No, I completely agree. When I found out my brother died, I was in Houston, Texas, working in a really horrible hotel room. And I immediately got on a plane in Dallas, drove to Los Angeles or flew to Los Angeles where he was and spent time with his family. I didn't get home a week later. I had to do a 24-hour drive from Houston all the way back home by myself. It wasn't until I got home that I really let go. So I completely understand where you're coming from.
Yeah. That 24-hour drive was just kind of numb?
Oh, I don't remember it. I don't remember the plane rides. I don't remember being in Los Angeles. I don't remember a thing.
And that memory loss is very common, too. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Tim, what do you think?
Yeah. Personally, even now, I don't have the same recollection of my sister and stories that people tell. That's why I love meeting people that tell me stories about my sister. Is I think that was my defense mechanism. Is I blocked it out. I can't remember sometimes what she looks like and things like that. So that's why it's so important, you know, that we talk about these things, because then you get the stories and everything. But the numb part is I can definitely see that. And we're coming up on a time, I think, with the holidays that it also is another tough time. Which all the more reason why I'm sure I speak on your behalf from what you said of we want people to tell us those things. You know, we want to remember it that way.
Yeah. Adrian, you want to weigh in too?
Postvention is prevention with suicide care. And so I just want to mention if numbness can be a warning sign of suicide. So the way I would look at that as a mental health professional is to like always take it seriously and just ask a person, ask more, and So if a friend or a family member is experiencing numbness, it's okay to check in and ask them how they're doing.
Yeah, because again, that goes along with what we learned from Dr. David Brent, psychiatrist at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, whose research finds that a first-degree relative of a person who has died by suicide is 4 to 6 times more likely to attempt suicide, which is why I think Adrian says postvention is still prevention. Right?
Exactly.
Okay. One more time, Adrian, where you want people to know about resources in our community that are available for those who need them?
There are a lot of counselors out there that are, you know, well-equipped to work with post-traumatic stress disorder and trauma. Anyone is welcome to call the Center for Compassion and Healing to be led in the right direction. There are a lot of support groups out there for children. There are general bereavement groups. There are, you know, support groups available for people who have lost a child. There's a lot available. So if you just need some direction, I'd be happy to help with that after.
Okay. And Tim and Pat, you got to let people know how to get involved with Superfly and Meg's Gift. Superfly is online. There's a Facebook page. And there's going to be more to come in the future from them.
But absolutely.
When's the event, by the way?
It's in this year. It'll actually, or this coming year, it'll actually be on his birthday in August, on August 5th.
I hope you have continued success there. I know you will, and you've built something really important in that memory. I know the Veterans Outreach Center appreciates it. I know Meg's Gift benefits a number of different entities that help with suicide loss and prevention. Online where, Tim Garbach?
It's megsgift.org, and social media. Put in Meg's Gift, and you'll find us.
Thank you to both of our guests who are telling the stories of the loss in their family. Just admire you and appreciate it, and continued success in your families, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Tim, Pat, and our thanks to Adrian Daniels, the manager of Bereavement Services for Lifetime Care. Thank you as well, Adrian. Thanks for being here. Rob Braden, the engineer. Audrey Sample is the intern. Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. And have a nice afternoon. We're right back with you Tuesday on Member Supported Public Radio.